Welcome to the Voices in Recovery podcast. Voices in Recovery is produced by Freedom's Path Recovery Society, a registered Canadian charity. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider a donation at www.freedomspathrecoverysociety.ca. All donations go directly to assisting Freedom's Path and providing services free of charge and helps us keep the podcast going. We are grateful for any and all donations. This podcast discusses difficult topics such as childhood abuse, drug and alcohol use, sexuality, sexualized trauma, and more. If you are under the age of 18, please speak with your legal guardian prior to listening. The opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individual and not those of Voices in Recovery or Freedom's Path Recovery Society. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.
This podcast is being recorded on the traditional land of the Blackfoot Confederacy. This consists of the Kainai, Piikani, Siksika, and the Blackfeet in the U.S. We acknowledge the Stoney Nakoda, which consists of the Bearspaw, Morley, and Chiniki. We acknowledge the Tsuut'ina who are Dene, and the Métis Inuit status and non-status from all of Turtle Island, and those who are visiting. We are all treaty people.
Danielle,
yeah,
welcome back.
Hi.
Hi, and you came back. You came on for the first time, a couple months ago, right?
In October.
Was it October that already?
Or maybe November?
Gosh, it has been a few months. Hey.
At least October or November.
October, November. So a few months ago, and now you're back, and I'm just so happy to see you. Lots of reasons. Oh yeah, like for lots of reasons. Because I think first of all you're cute, so it's always nice to see you.
I don't think you're allowed to say that on air.
I can.
Oh, it's your podcast.
I'm just going to take the liberty and say it.
Okay.
And so it's really nice to have you back.
Yeah, it's good to be back.
I wish the circumstances were different as to like what we're going to talk about today.
Right? Yeah, but because it's good that we're talking about it. Mm-hmm. It makes me feel better to talk about it.
Okay.
Just with the right people.
Yeah, for sure. So fair enough. Why don't you talk about it then? Tell us what you've been, what's been going on. What happened?
Oh yes. What happened?
Yeah, what happened? What is it like?
I had a mental breakdown.
Oh my god!
very publicly.
And I'm not laughing at her, by the way, for having a mental breakdown. It was just the way that we transitioned into that.
I'm allowed to laugh about my trauma.
You are absolutely.
You know what
allowed.
I mean? Give me at least that world.
Well, you're allowed.
Well, so are you. It's nice. You know that someone's safe if they laugh at a trauma joke. You're like, oh, you're like me too.
Well, and it's because of my own trauma. So
yeah.
So we're welcome. The same that welcome way. To so the podcast.
Thank you. Yeah. So I had a mental breakdown in January.
Okay.
I knew that it was coming, as you always do. Mm-hmm. I had a rough winter.
Okay. So what was the for you? Because I know for you and me, we know when it's coming because we've experienced it. How does it feel if you could describe it to people who don't know what it's like to have a mental illness?
Okay. Easy. Yeah. Okay,
right on.
So first, things sort of start to get sped up for me a little bit, and I'm just having like more interactions and doing more things, and things are sort of increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm starting to get paranoid about things too.
Okay.
So like my social interaction is increasing, and my paranoia is increasing,
yeah.
And I'm sort of running that out with speed, I guess.
Yeah.
And I can feel it, and it's like in all of the back of all of the moments that I'm living, there's like this weird little gnawing of just like something that's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's coming and I know it's going to come. And I watch it increase. Like I sort of watch myself lose the ability to regulate my emotions, show up in the world in a way that is grounded and rooted in fact, I guess. I sort of lose my grip on how I'm fitting in, and I'm aware that people are noticing that I'm starting to slip, and so I'm desperately trying to mask that. So that's usually how I know. I start to feel like I'll come home and I'll be like, ooh, that interaction was weird. Like I'll feel embarrassed and I'll be like, I shouldn't have said that to that person, or I was too much in that moment. And those just sort of start to stack and happen more and more and more. And then you get to this point where you're like really raw and ready for it. And that's kind of how I know.
And then it hits you like a ton of bricks. And then
Yeah. And sometimes it's nice when it hits at first.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, the anticipation of the hitting is always what's hard about being mentally ill. I always tell people, like, do I have good moments? Absolutely. But there's always like a shadow in those good moments because I know there'll be a low.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's hard. It's kind of there.
And thank you for talking about that, because it's like, it's one thing for us. We know what it's like. Like I know what's happening to me when I'm almost in the tank. When I feel the abyss coming, it's like I can feel it for about a week ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
I can't stop it. I just have to like kind of slow myself down enough so that I don't get hurt, right? And I don't mm-hmm. hurt, I don't hurt others. Because for me, that's where my privilege comes into play, where I have a place to live, where I can mm-hmm. retreat to avoid sharing some of those negative behaviors with other people, right? However, on the flip side of that, when the mania comes, this is why, like, for me, the manic side of whatever illness I have, because obviously we've talked about it before,
yeah.
like, it's borderline, maybe bipolar, maybe both, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe a combination of all those lovely things.
It's probably everything that ends in a D.
Yeah, and a very...
That's what I say. I always say I got the starter pack and then the deluxe, too.
Yeah, the deluxe.
Because yeah. that's what happens over time. It compounds and changes into other things, I think.
100%. Well, and I believe that, too, right? So, I mean, because I've seen it not only in myself, but in other people, where... Mm-hmm. where even when we're treating it. And so this is something that people don't understand. So before we go back into your story, mm-hmm. like one of the things people in the general community don't understand is that we have no control over it. No. They think we do, right? They think
and it's
we
not should always related to stimuli. 100%. Sometimes it is, but yeah. I experience lows when things are fine.
Yeah, that's exactly my point, is that it's there's something different in the way our brain perceives information. In the way our brain mm-hmm. perceives it, receives it, and processes it. Mm-hmm. And so in order for people to really understand who don't have mental illness, that's really the focus, is for my, in my mind, to say, hey, here's the truth of it. I have no control over it when it starts. The best I can do is take the medicine I've been given, talk to people that I've been told to talk to, and I do those things. But even when I do those things perfectly well, mm-hmm. it doesn't take anything because my brain is not the same, right? It doesn't mm-hmm. perceive, receive, and process information in the same way someone without BPD or bipolar might process it, right?
Yeah.
And so knowing that that's our processor, like this is not something that we can like will ourselves out of, right? Mm-mm. As much as some people who use mental illness and addiction in a political like forum, that's what they want people to believe. Mm-hmm. Because it's political. Because
then
way.
You can exploit us.
Yeah, you can exploit
and not
us.
Give us rights and access to resources.
Thank
and,
you very much. Yeah. Right?
And
you
big can, bang boom. One big, plus one.
100%. And it equals like more dead people because yeah. but
which is the goal.
We have yeah, exactly. We have to remember that the goal is for certain parties to actually get rid of certain people mm-hmm. because it benefits their constituency. But nobody wants to believe this is true. Mm-hmm. Anyway, now we're two yeah. people who yeah, yeah, are admittedly yeah. mentally ill.
Admittedly.
And at the same time, I don't want to break off into like a conspiracy thing. But the truth is, it's not conspiracy. Those of us who've lived this and have to experience, I don't know what the word is.
Late stage capitalism.
Yeah, that.
And
that,
survive it.
That and being neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Right? In different ways. Like it, I wish I could just express it to people enough to that they all would have to understand is that we perceive, we receive, and we process information differently because that's how our brain is. If we could have it any other way, would we not choose another way? Mm-hmm. 100%, right? Mm-hmm. So, and people who think like, oh, you're just fucking lazy. You just don't want to work. Like, mm-hmm. you're just claiming up this mental illness so you can get some sympathy and all this kind of stuff. And this is going to transition into your story because mm-hmm. this is how hard it really is to get help when you want to get help. That's why Danielle's here, right? Mm-hmm. Is because she's just recently gone through this process and experienced.
Going through it.
Is still going through it. But
and experiencing as a white woman. So let's just make mm-hmm. sure that like I'll own that right now. This is like a very privileged take. This is probably the best possible scenario.
100%. And this and the fact that this is potentially the best possible scenario for a human is tragic.
Yeah. If this is what our healthcare is giving like the most privileged person.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, so please, take it away. I just wanted to try to preface it for people because I know I get in the habit of talking about mental illness and not really talking about it in a way that others might understand.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah, I mean, I don't surround myself with a lot of neurotypical people mm-hmm. just because I find it really hard at this age to, like, continue to have to mask with friends.
Yeah.
If I have to do that, like, as a regular part of my day, I need friends who are, like, going to understand if I can't text you back for a week, yeah. if I don't show up last minute. It, mm-hmm. Like, I can't have people that are going to get hung up on weird stuff like that because mm-hmm. sometimes I just am not right.
Yeah.
And I need people who get that. So, yes, I do forget that not everybody understands this. Mm-hmm. And I also think the experience of being mentally ill is something that we're only allowed to talk about in a, like, Bell Let's Talk way.
Yeah.
You know, like in a story of, like, advocacy and empowerment and blah, blah, blah.
And how we became high-functioning members of society.
Yeah, and actually being high-functioning is what's killing me. Yeah. It's actually definitely, if anything's going to kill me, it'll probably be that.
well, trying to maintain that, right? Like trying
Yeah, just because I lie a lot from the stigma and the shame, right? High functioning just means I lie really well. And that's like something that I'll admit, you know, I've figured out that it is embarrassing to show up in the world as I am and that it makes other people uncomfortable. So I've just crafted a really good way of doing it alone, which is dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous. And I think that's probably the difference today for me is that I went away from not talking to the people that I cared about to talking to them, like involving them.
Yeah, I think
in
that's
that.
The journey.
Yeah.
I'm really trying to do that. It's really hard though.
Super hard because we've only experienced up until this point, I'll speak for myself, I've only experienced like very few bits of support from people and most of them are my closest people.
Support is an interesting word. It's like, I think everyone in my life has tried to be supportive, but it maybe hasn't read that way to me. And this is why I think we need to like listen more to people that are actually experiencing mental illness, because I do think that people have well intentions when they speak to me about it, but it's a very like removed way. It's like, don't make your mental illness your personality. It's like, okay, but I have a personality disorder.
So that's kind of what's going on for me, man.
Yeah. Like, I gotta be honest, you know? I don't agree with over-identifying, and I think it's definitely used to deny me care for sure sometimes.
But isn't that part of that? Like, we talked a little bit about this the last time we talked, was about that Pollyanna view of wellness, right?
Yeah.
Like, and this ties into that. The difficulty in getting real help ties into the fact that there is all these Pollyanna viewpoints of wellness because, well, why can't you just get over it? Why can't you just like, you know, good vibes only? We talked about that last time, right?
Like that, like sort of like positive woke, like new age, super healing. Just don't feel it at all, man.
Well, that, and that skips the work. Right?
Yeah. It also removes you from yourself, which 100%. Isn't the goal of wellness.
No.
The goal of wellness is to be inside of it, even if it's ugly, I think.
I agree, right? And so you have, like, volunteered to share what you've been through over the last little while, and I keep talking because that's what we do.
We like talking about this stuff.
When we hang out, we talk. So, so it's, anyway. It has been, for my, as your friend, as someone, like, who cares about you a great deal, I'm so glad that you didn't give up.
I mean, I'm still not sure.
I get it.
I'm not far down the road yet. That's the other thing.
So far, you haven't given up.
Yeah, so far, I haven't given up.
Really glad.
Thank you. That's nice of you. Yeah, no. So I fully knew that I was going to have I don't want to speak about it so like lightheartedly. I knew that I was going to have a psychotic episode. I knew that I was splitting from reality. I knew that I was starting to become manic. Like, I recognize this. And mania is new for me. It's something I've only experienced in the last 5 years. And I knew it was happening. I had a breakup at the time, which is a super big trigger for me. I was unhappy in my work. I was unsafe in some of my work. I was stuck in sort of a fight or flight. And yeah, I reached out and tried to get help and I couldn't get any help. It was December. It was Christmas time. Everywhere was full. I filled out applications for places. Nobody called me back. I called places. Nobody answered. I left voicemails. Nobody phoned me back. Which I think people don't understand how discouraging that is when you're trying to get help. When you finally like pull yourself out of the shame and the stigma of going down again and you ask for help when that's hard for you and there's no help at all, it's a pretty overwhelming feeling.
Yeah.
And I definitely think that it really leads to suicidal ideation because it's kind of a hopeless feeling. It's like, oof, I finally surrendered and there's nothing here. Like, it's nothing. Yeah. And this is somebody who has a cell phone and the ability to phone these places. You know, the thing that I didn't have was a family doctor. So that's another thing that a lot of folks don't know. We very much have a two-tiered health system, those who have a family doctor and those who don't. And there's lots of reasons why I don't have a family doctor. I've never felt safe with a medical professional. I've never felt heard by a medical professional. So I've never stayed anywhere very long. I have some trauma with medical stuff. I don't like going to the doctor. It's never been a positive experience for me. So yeah, there were a lot of resources that I couldn't get right away. And all of the resources had massive wait lists. So I got no help in December and just sort of ate that. Like, what are you going to do? Yeah. You know, the thing about having BPD, I think, is I know when other people are tapped out and I know that I've tapped them out. You know, my friends and family can only do so much when I'm stuck in that spiraling thinking because it's incredibly frustrating and annoying and painful and confusing for others. I can totally understand that. I'll get stuck on a thought and I will spiral about it for weeks, just in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out. And it doesn't seem to go away no matter what I do. And that's annoying for people. So
it must be annoying for you too.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's really annoying for me. Yeah. It's super hard, especially when I know that it's not serving me.
Yeah. It's torturous, right?
Yeah. The spiraling is really hard.
Well, and that's another thing that people have a hard time understanding is like, why is it so hard? Right? Well, because we have no control in it. We're being tortured by our own brain.
Yeah, and nothing makes it go away.
100%.
I could walk into the middle of the river in the winter and do like everything I could do to shock my system, and I'd still get out and probably still be spiraling a little. And that's something that I think we deny the mental health community.
Of course,
you know,
we do.
The skills work, and learn the skills and do anything that you can to equip yourself with wellness if you're able to, if you have the financial ability to do that. Because let's be honest, I can't work right now, obviously, and I can't afford not to work. So that's the other part of this. So I was working a lot. I knew this was coming. I tried to get help. I couldn't get help. I just threw myself back into everything and put my head down and tried to survive it. Didn't really work out that way. I had, I ended up lapsing on some substances and just getting to like an unsafe place in my own head, and ended up phoning the community paramedics on myself on January 28th because I knew I needed some help, but I didn't want to go to the hospital. And that's the interesting thing I think that folks don't really know about is like, you don't really have a lot of options as a mentally ill person when you're in crisis. You either have like stay at home and hide it and hope that you get through it, or burden a friend or family member who it is a burden for, because, and I don't want other people to feel that way. This is very much how I feel about myself.
Yeah.
So I just want to state right now that candidness and the way that I'm speaking about mental illness, this is not how I feel as an advocate. So I feel as a human, as Danielle,
experiencing it.
And it's ripe with internalized stigma and really, really bad messaging to my own self. But I'm just sharing honestly and openly what it's like for me.
Yeah.
So yeah, you have that option, or you can go to the hospital. But the hospital is this like very interesting place where maybe you go and they tell you you're fine, go home. Maybe you go and you get admitted for 3 days and pumped full of benzos, which are my substance of choice. So it's like I would just be withdrawing from the drugs and then going in and getting those drugs and then being released and withdrawing from them again and probably trying to find a street source of them.
To stabilize your withdrawal.
To stabilize my withdrawal, which is really dangerous. And and that is what happened to me. When I couldn't get that care, I started managing with street benzos, so street Xanax and street Percocets, because I needed something so that I could continue working. Because I was manic, I tried to get care, I couldn't get care. I knew I was making people uncomfortable. I knew I needed to take it down. So I bought street benzos because I don't have a family doctor. I can't get a script that way. I don't have a psychiatrist. I've never had a psychiatrist. I saw one once for 10 minutes. So I don't think, people think that like, oh, things are wrong. You just run down the street and get the thing and then you take the pill and you're good. It doesn't actually work like that. And
not even close.
All this stuff takes time. And what do you not have in a crisis necessarily sometimes is time. Because for me, things escalate really quickly because I get very disassociated. And so I start engaging in risky behaviors because it helps me feel back in my body. I think that's what folks don't understand is for me, the risky behaviors is because I feel so detached from myself. So I'm triggered and traumatized. I'm in fight or flight. So my system protects me by disassociating.
Yeah.
But then I feel hollow, numb, and not real. So I jump back into my body by engaging in a risky behavior.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of them. And I want to make that clear that substances is not the only risky behavior I engage in. It's not the most damaging risky behavior that I engage in. It's just a part of what it's like for me when I'm in crisis.
Because you're in, when we say, when you say engage in, these are things that we engage in order to self-medicate and self-soothe.
I'm trying to bring myself down.
100%.
And that's the thing is like things like cutting are actually really effective at bringing you down.
Yep,
and when you have BPD, you go to a very heightened place very quickly. And so there is a relief in that sort of self-harm behavior. It does regulate me and bring me back into my body. It also is horrible for my life, but it's effective. And that's why I've continued to rely on it for 35 years, even though I don't want to anymore. And I'm trying not to now, but I have to lead myself and guide myself through that like I was a child. And that takes a lot of time and work.
And energy.
So yeah, so I called the paramedics on myself and my option was to go to the hospital or to detox at home. I chose to detox at home. I moved back in with my dad. I lived with my dad for a month and I tried to access resources. So I went to the Rapid Access Mental Health Clinic.
That's RAM, right?
Yeah, that's RAM through the Alex, through AHS. And this, once again, these are all my opinions. Mm-hmm. I felt like the focus when I was there was really on Suboxone. And no shade to Suboxone. I think it is a beautiful resource. If you like it and you want it, rock the fuck on. I hope you get it exactly as you want it.
Probably saves lives, right?
Yeah. Like community-led, babe, no mm-hmm. shame. But for me, I didn't like Suboxone. Mm-hmm. For me, it gave me a lot of suicidal ideation. Mm-hmm. It made me feel very depressed. And it was also confusing because I was not a daily opioid user. Mm-hmm. My lapses are sporadic and sort of in like a binge style. That's just my personal journey. Mm-hmm. Also sometimes more dangerous because you lose your tolerance. And so when, yeah.
So what is Suboxone for those out there who don't know?
Yeah. So Suboxone is basically a replacement for an opioid. Okay. So because I started taking those benzos to calm myself down mm-hmm. and keep my job and show up in the world, and because they were street benzos and because we have a toxic supply, mm-hmm. they were laced with fentanyl. So I'm buying benzos, but I'm actually consuming fentanyl, which is an opioid.
Yeah.
So this is what we're talking about when we talk about the need for safe supply. Mm-hmm. In that moment, I truly, as a human, felt like I needed something to bring me down to continue living and working my job.
Yeah.
That is the adult decision that I made that I thought was the lesser of two evils.
The key is, you said, to continue living.
To continue living, yes.
Work is, I get it, but continue living, just to live.
Totally, to get me through that moment without the resources that I can't get into right now. So because I don't have the ability to buy that, because we have a toxic supply and everything has fentanyl in it, I was not knowingly consuming fentanyl.
Yeah.
And I never want to demonize fentanyl because that's too fucking easy for the system. The problem and the bad guy in my life, I want to make sure we note, is not substance use. It is threat of poverty. It is a housing crisis. It is lack of mental health resources.
Poisonous drugs.
Yeah, it's a toxic drug supply. It's lack of safe resources. Mm-hmm. Like, I work in harm reduction, so when I bought those pills, I should have taken them to get tested. Mm-hmm. I should have tested them myself and should have, right? But what did I do because of stigma? None of that. Because I wanted no one to know that I wasn't doing well because of my own internalized stigma. Mm-hmm. I can see it for other people, but it's really hard to see it for yourself because mm-hmm. you've experienced years of stigma, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so I was unknowingly consuming that. So Suboxone is basically something to help people get off of fentanyl. Yeah. So it's kind of like the new methadone.
I was going to say that. It's replaced methadone kind of as
the go-to? Yeah, because methadone, they have noted, is addictive, and they're saying that Suboxone is not. And I'm not saying anything about Suboxone because I'm not a neuroscientist. Yeah. But for me, I hated it.
Yeah.
For me, it made me incredibly depressed incredibly quickly. I've always had a history of med sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other thing. Folks are maybe like, well, did she stop taking her meds? No, I didn't stop taking my meds because I've never had meds.
Mm-hmm.
So because I have a history of substance use with pills, meds have always been something that has been difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
I have never found a med that worked. I don't really understand what is all going on with my mental illness, to be honest, either, because I was assessed once in 2017 at a time that a lot of other things was going on. I was in an abusive marriage. Mm-hmm. So I would love to be assessed now,
mm-hmm.
but I cannot get anyone to assess me. So you would think, so I call the community paramedics. I mm-hmm. say, hey, I need help. You would think I would get like mental health help, like a psychiatrist, a therapist. No, I didn't get any of that. Yeah. I got Suboxone, which didn't work for me.
Yeah.
And the other thing too is when I had to do the intake for that place,
mm-hmm.
it's super lengthy, super involved. I don't think people know what these intakes are like either. Like mm-hmm. they say, oh, just go down to CUPS and do the thing. People are complaining. It's so easy. Have you ever tried to access a resource? Because mm-hmm. it's really hard.
Oh, it's made to be hard.
It's really triggering and traumatizing. Mm-hmm. You have to sit there and you have to talk about every bad thing that's ever happened to you at arguably the lowest time mm-hmm. of your life to a complete stranger.
And to someone who's not a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
The first time you do it, it's not to a psychiatrist.
No, it's like the nurse that's doing the intake.
And has
the psychiatrist doesn't even, I think they just skim the notes.
Yeah, most likely.
I don't even know if they read my full file because I think it's interesting that I was prescribed something daily when my use wasn't daily.
Yeah.
But that's just my opinion about the thing.
Well, they're just trying to get a broad stroke and make sure you stay alive.
Yeah, and that's all I'm saying about this, right?
Yeah,
I'm 100%. Saying Suboxone is great, but it's just not the right resource for everybody.
For you. Yep.
What I need is an antipsychotic.
Mm-hmm.
What I need is a proper psych assessment. What I need is access to therapy. What I need is some subsidy right now while I'm focusing on my mental health mm-hmm. so that I cannot lose my apartment, so that I cannot be houseless.
Mm-hmm.
So what I need is some help from the system, which I guess is where conservatives folks would come in and say that I'm like mooching off the system and I should do this on my own. And it's too bad that you're sad. Keep working. But I just feel like if I was like diagnosed with cancer or something, we wouldn't say that to me.
We would never say that to people with physical illness. Yeah.
Ever.
Never.
And for me, it shows up in my body just as much as it shows up in my mind.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know that.
Oh, yeah. Shows up in my body all the time.
Yeah, like, I'm sore all the time. I'm in pain all the time. I don't think folks realize how real it is, like, how much it's not just, like, a sad day. Like, I've been stuck in a fight-or-flight trauma response for probably the last 15 years of my life. I can't even remember November and December, really.
Yeah.
Like, I'm telling you this story, but when I think about it, it doesn't even feel like it happened to me. That's how, like, removed I am from my own existence.
And for folks who don't understand what dissociation is, like, that's one of the things that comes for that I've experienced with BPD and bipolar, whatever it is that's going on in my brain. The ability to dissociate for long periods of time is constant.
Like, and it's scary.
Terrifying.
Like, I Absolutely. Feel, like, very hollow and unreal when I think about the fact that I don't remember that month.
Yeah.
Because that's how unwell I was.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, so I've been trying to engage in resource and trying to get a psychiatrist, and the wait lists are just, like, 3 to 4 months. And, you know, the wait list for assistance is, like, 6 months. And it's like, well, I will lose my apartment in 6 months. So I'll have to go get another job, which is what I'll do, right? And what I have the privilege of doing, I guess, because I'm still in an apartment and I still have the ability to save it if I work really, really hard. But I just don't think folks realize, like, I, you know, so I moved back in with my dad for a month and I didn't get any resource in that month. And my dad's not a psychiatrist. My dad's not a doctor, you know, and it was a very scary time for my family. And I have empathy for that too. You know, the people who love folks with mental illness don't know how to support us. And I think it's because the reality is that there isn't really a way to support us right now under our current system.
Yeah. Well, and there seems to be lots of disconnects as to how we should be treated in general anyway.
Yeah, or even validated or heard, you know. 100%. Like, I saw a doctor, and this is like a positive shout out after sort of my more negative one. A couple of days ago, I went to CUPS and saw another doctor because I wanted to get another opinion. And she was amazing and so validating. Like, I could cry thinking about it. She asked me, you know, the last time that I had felt like totally well and totally stable. And I told her that I had never felt that way. And usually when I say that stuff to people, they're just like, okay, well, make the best of it. Like, that's not really a good approach.
They just roll their eyes.
Or they don't say anything or whatever, right? And she said, she looked at me and she was like, that sounds really hard. And that seems so simple, but holy hell, like, that healed me more than anything a medical professional had ever said, that she just acknowledged that, like, it might be hard for me.
Because it's real.
Because it is hard for me.
And it is real.
Yeah, and I guess that was, like, the first time I'd ever experienced that, you know, and I'm 34. I've never felt that from a doctor, that they felt like what I was experiencing wasn't just real, but valid and painful and hard. I don't really get that from too many people.
And I agree. I don't think that, and I'm glad we don't get it from everybody, you know, but I think, like, a lot
Why?
Well, because then it would...
I want it from everyone! Well, but it
would, to me, it would then start turning into, like, pity, and I don't want pity, right? If we're going to get support, I want support. I don't want pity. But because
that's true. Because I just wish we were more naturally validating as a society.
That's exactly it. Like, I wish... And maybe one day we'll become that way. Like, more like, overall empathetic.
Because it feels so good, you know?
It does. And it feels good to give it to people.
I know.
Right?
It was like when we had that conversation after I went away. Before I went away, I was really mean to Dave one day when I wasn't doing well. And when I started coming back and talking to you again, and I apologized to you, and we had that conversation and we actually talked about it. Instead of just not talking about it, you know? And you validated that, like, it wasn't me and that you understood that. That was also the first time I've ever had someone do that as someone who's mentally ill.
Really?
You know? Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that we did. I mean, obviously, I'm glad we talked for many reasons.
Totally.
But that was,
but
like...
But we had a real moment, right? And of you validated me. And it was like me and that doctor. We had a real moment. Because that's the thing about mental illness, is I think people are so afraid and uncomfortable because they don't know how to react.
Yeah.
That they sort of just, like, remove themselves entirely. Because they don't want to walk into any uncomfortable space, you know? And, like, I remember I said to the doctor, I was like, there's not really anything for me to do immediately, is there? And usually a doctor will be like, well, you know, make some excuse. But she just looked at me and she was like, no. And that's another thing that I think that we aren't doing in the medical professionals is we're not, and even in the social services, we're not validating people's reality. Mm-hmm. Because it makes us uncomfortable.
Well, it makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah. Like when someone tells me that they're really deeply struggling, mm-hmm. I don't hand them a Kleenex box to shut them up. No. I don't try to turn it into some like beautiful story of adversity. I just look at them and go like, yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like when I'm doing outreach and folks are like, I'm asking them if there's anywhere they want to go for the night and they start laughing and I'm like, yeah, I know there's nowhere you feel safe. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't deny them that. I don't say like, well, go to Alpha, make the best of it, man. I don't want to go to Alpha House.
I
like,
know.
Sorry, Alpha House. But like, I wouldn't want to go there, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like we deny the right of people to even validate their struggle by talking about it because it makes us so goddamn uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's better, I think, to just have someone look at you and be like, yeah, you are in a hopeless situation right now.
And it's super awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't have an answer.
I don't have an answer. The system is not working right now. You can't get help right away. And so, I can't get help right away. Mm-hmm. That's basically the story. And it's like an interesting thing. You know, I don't want to live with my dad anymore. I want to come back and live in my apartment because I want my autonomy, you know, because there's so few things that you have.
Oh, yeah.
My little apartment where I can like be alone and have one tiny little thing in this world means a lot to me.
Well, it means a lot, right? Like it means a lot. It's like that, what we were talking about, I can't remember when, but it's just like the ability to have a place to go is in itself its own privilege, right?
Like, absolutely. And once again, I can't imagine if I was going through this and didn't even have that one grace of a place to live.
And that's the norm for people is they don't.
100%.
Right?
And that's why the crisis is not fentanyl. The crisis is lack of fucking housing.
Yeah.
The crisis is no rent cap. Poverty. You know, we have a cap on poverty is the crisis. Poverty is the enemy. Mm-hmm. The enemy is not fentanyl.
And it's not addiction. It's not
any of the things they want to tell you that it is. No. It is that folks are experiencing a chronic level of poverty and poverty is crisis. Mm-hmm. I'm dancing just above it. You know, I'm just on that poverty line. I have enough rent for a couple more months and then that's it. So I better figure out something quick, you know? Mm-hmm. And I do feel that threat every single day. And I have felt this threat for the last 15 years because I've always had to have some strange side hustle because I haven't lived a neurotypical life.
Well, but that's because you might not be able to.
Yeah, it's also because I was experiencing complex PTSD, you know? It's not an excuse, but it's just
part of the process.
I didn't have the same 15 years that everybody had. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't have the same experience in high school. I didn't have the same experience deciding what I was going to do and who I was going to be because I was just trying to stay alive. Mm-hmm. So I didn't think about those things. I didn't think about what steps do I need to take so I can be safe and regulated. And maybe that's confusing for you to understand, but then I guess you've never tried to just stay alive. Mm-hmm. Because that was all I was trying to do at that age.
Yeah.
Adolescence was such an intense time for me, and I just wanted to survive it.
Yeah.
So I didn't make any plans.
Yeah. And I was the same.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was going to do just because I was just trying to survive. I was trying to keep myself from being found out, being queer.
It's funny. You threw yourself into everything, and I just threw myself into nothing.
Yeah.
We went separate ways from the same wound.
Totally. And I had the guidance of like...
religion.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Religion, I had down in the States, I grew up with nationalism, like
totally patriotism.
So that
there
when
was a group for you in 100%. Your life.
And so by the time I was 18, I was just going to the army. Like that was what I was doing, right? Because that was the most natural thing in the world. And then when I got in the army and was like, fuck this, like listening to people tell you what to do.
I like just, literally can't even
It was awful. It's just awful. For a person like me, it was it was awful because all I feel is like, oh my God.
You hate being told what to do.
100%.
That must have been so bad for you. It was awful. That is one thing I know about you.
Hell yeah.
You do not want a rule.
I do not. I don't like rules.
No,
I'm not a fan.
Thanks.
And so it was even funny because one of my friends back then said, well, why would you go? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm like,
to be
honestly,
a man, man.
It was just like that. There was just that pump in the back of the head going, that's what feels good. Do that. Go there. Do that. Right? Like,
and then, that's the lack of sense of self, I think, with BPD.
100%.
Because all of my decisions feel like that, too. Like, I'm not really sure why I went that way. It's just the way we were going at the time. So I held on.
Yeah. It was the way the flow was flowing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the flow was flowing. I got out of the army. I came here. I realized, fuck, if I keep living the way I was, like stealing and shit, I'm going to end up in fucking jail. Right? Mm-hmm. So I chose perfectly the other way to hide. Like, well, if I'm around people who are aggressive, who are ignorant and who are like basically just like me. I was ignorant. I was aggressive.
He's talking about the cops, by the way.
Yeah,
not
well,
the people.
I'm talking about working in law enforcement, gradually getting into law enforcement where you are technically just by the people you're around more aggressive people.
You are, right? Bang on. And it would naturally lead people that were more akin to that kind of lifestyle no matter what.
100%.
So sometimes that would be narcissistic people, sometimes it wouldn't.
Yeah.
But that's why it's really important that we're constantly evaluating cops.
I agree.
And we're not.
I know, and it needs to be evaluated differently, right? Like there's
And that also comes back to a level of understanding about mental illnesses and care for those folks, because the people that the system is failing are those people. The people that are getting mishandled by cops are people who are in psychosis. You know, I am lucky that I have never had to live with the threat of the police because I'm a white woman. You know, I've had public psychotic episodes. I have, and that is the other thing that is hard too, is like the level of shame, you know, when you have a, like, I really feel like there's a hierarchy within mental illness. And I feel like with the general public, they have made certain mental illnesses okay. Like, I still think there's a lot of stigma, but I think something like anxiety and depression has a little bit more empathy than a personality disorder, because some of my behaviors when I get unwell can be really uncomfortable for folks, you know? Yeah. Like sometimes I hit myself, and that's pretty overwhelming for people to hear, you know? And even embarrassing to say as a 34-year-old woman, but it is the truth.
And, well, and those as a 49-year-old man, I hit myself too.
Yeah.
To try to calm myself down.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
I've just been fortunate to be able to do it behind closed doors, right? Where I just hit myself in the head and try to get myself to just stop.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, sometimes I publicly, like this last one, when I sort of fell apart, I publicly freaked out on a bunch of forums and like a bunch of job situations. So I feel like deeply embarrassed and humiliated now. And that also comes back to the work, is it's like, I spent a year trying to work in the social sector, and now I, can't get any help within the social sector myself. So it's a very interesting feeling for me as a person. And
I believe it's telling. I believe your experience, though, is pretty telling and pretty common for what it's like to try to work in the human services sector when you actually give a shit. Like,
yeah.
It becomes
and you
different.
You recognize how many of that's the thing that's been really hard for me, and the thing that's been really that really contributed to my mental breakdown was just realizing that, like, all the work that I was doing with advocacy and everything that I was doing that I thought like was such making such an important impact, I was realizing wasn't that, because the right now nothing is being led by lived and living experience. We get a seat at the table, but we get one seat, you know? And I think it's so important that that changes, because I don't think that you can have a truly like deep understanding of these things if you haven't experienced them.
For sure.
I think you can read a textbook about them and you can understand them, and I think you have a place too, and I'm not dogging you in any way.
Of course not.
But until you have like burned your life to the ground and publicly humiliated yourself in a state of mania, I don't know if you can really understand that.
Yeah, how could you? How could someone? And that's and if it's okay that people don't fully understand. I think the idea for me is for folks just to realize they don't understand and to realize
and
that it's
I
not
I think that's
simple.
Really hard for neurotypicals to say.
It is.
Much like it's hard for people to admit their privilege, which we've talked about before.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to admit that being neurotypical is a privilege.
Yeah.
Like how many folks probably just like were grossed out when I said that. They were like, no, but it is.
They'll be cringing.
It is.
It's 100% is. Yeah.
And we're never allowed to take that and take that space and that validation. So...
Well, this takes me.
Oh,
this takes me back to. This is yours.
Oh, my ear. Thank you. I was gonna be
You're really welcome.
Bummed about this.
You're welcome. So what were we talking about? Sorry, I got distracted.
Mental illness and yeah, that's what we've been talking about the whole time, right?
Yeah. What was the last thing we were talking about?
I have
Darcy?
No clue. He doesn't know.
He was listening for sure.
He wasn't listening. Fired, Darcy.
So, like, what you're talking about in terms of just how everything piles up and that, like, and the privilege, that's right. And the difference between what privilege really looks like, right? Like, so if we just simply said this, and I'm going to say this, and everybody out there, you can get mad at me, it's all good. I appreciate the anger and I love the emails. So like,
oh my God, can you send me angry emails?
I don't really get any angry emails anymore.
I love an angry email. Keep going.
If I do get one, I'll send it to you.
A good one? Someone send an angry email about me?
Yeah, somebody send an angry email.
Someone who's listening, say we hate this girl. I need it, okay? I need to feel something.
Well, here's the thing about that even, about people making comments about stuff. Like, I'm okay with people disagreeing, but if you're making comments, like, publicly, I will delete your comment if it's Islamophobic, if it's hateful.
Yeah, you don't get a right to speak there.
You don't get a right to speak that shit on my pages.
If it infringes on someone else's basic rights, we're good on that.
Yeah, so I won't even, like second those messages. But just thinking about that privilege, right? So you have, let's just make the most privileged person ever would be neurotypical.
Mm-hmm. Cis.
White.
Yeah, not probably.
I was going to say probably. Yeah, definitely white.
Male.
Comes from a family with money.
Yeah.
So that's like, that's the essence of privilege.
So the people who are running our government.
Yeah, the people who are running the country.
So that would never, right? The people that would never understand what it's like to experience this because they've never called a resource in their
life. Of course they would never say they're privileged.
No.
What they would claim is that they worked hard. But then it's like, okay, but who gave you the brain you have?
Yeah, not even that, man. Who gave you that job? Your dad's friends?
100%. And don't get me wrong, because I'm middle class, raised middle class, and nepotism's a big part of, like, life. Mm-hmm. It is. And being able to work with my dad, like, I know part of it was just because I was a kid.
Oh, yeah. Right? I forgot you worked with your dad.
100%.
But I wasn't even calling you out there.
It was, no, I know, but it's okay. I don't feel called out. I feel like it was different because I didn't work for my dad. Like, I worked for myself and he worked for himself and we were both just simply doing similar things, right? But at the same time, there was like, since he's passed away, that has changed. Like, I've gone back to who I was when I was young, right? Like, I've gone back to the social worker I was when I first started. I want to yell at people. I want to yell at the right people. I want to focus on poverty because I know that's the problem. I know that's the overall problem. It was when I started as a social worker 25 years ago. It still is today, right?
Yeah, and also just we need to get rid of the idea that poverty is like something that people have control over.
Yeah.
Because I think that's why we're not doing anything about it, is we're still pretending that it's this thing that you have control over, and it's not.
And that if you work hard enough, you'll be fine.
Like, if I wouldn't have had a father who had an apartment when I needed to go somewhere that wasn't the hospital, because what is the hospital? People don't understand. You don't just go to the hospital for a month. Mm-hmm. You're lucky if they admit you for 3 days. So
you're lucky if they keep you overnight.
Well, and you know what? You're not lucky because then you're exposed to a bunch of medical trauma, which is what's happened to me anytime I've had any experience in Emerge. You know, I had an Emerge doctor tell me once, or a nurse, a triage nurse, that if they admitted alcoholics like me, they'd have no beds for real people. And I've never forgotten that my entire life. And
that
I
makes
know
my
that
skin
that's
crawl.
I know that's how a lot of people feel.
Oh,
a
I
lot
know
of people
it. I've
feel
heard
like
say it.
Yeah. It's not a real story. It's not a real existence. It's not there's people that don't even believe in trauma, you know?
I've been out with some of the powers that be when they pick up folks and it's like, see, we're wasting our time. And I'm like, you're wasting your time taking someone for a psych eval. How is that a waste
of
your time?
Yeah, I mean, even just the idea that, like, you know, I've heard a lot, like, specifically about borderline, you know, I've heard a lot about, like, that we're, like, attention seeking.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? If I need more attention than another human being to be regulated and processed in my body, and that's just what my brain needs because of extreme damage, I'm really sorry, but that's what I need.
Yeah, sorry to offend you.
And I'm never allowed to ask for that, you know? I'm never allowed to say, like, it would be really helpful if the people in my life could co-process with me.
Mm-hmm.
It would be really helpful if the people in my life could just naturally validate me.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get to ask for those things when you're mentally ill. You're the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And you're supposed to be grateful for any help that you get. And I am grateful, but I can't get any help. You know, we circle back to that. What I got a 5-day substance use course. What did I need? Therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I did a 15-year substance use course. It's called My Life.
Mm-hmm.
I've identified that they're a problem for me.
Mm-hmm.
I know that.
Yeah.
I don't need to do a 5-day course. I needed therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And those are not resources that I can get. So right now, January 28th was when I phoned the medics on myself. It's March 1st.
Mm-hmm.
I just got a doctor because I have a friend who recommended, and it was through CUPS, and this woman's amazing. So that's great. That's a real win. But that took a month, and that took a lot of serious advocation on my part. I went to multiple places. I had a ride to those places. I had a phone so that I could call for those appointments. Like, boom, 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 privilege up the wall right there. I was able to do all of that and fight for it and have multiple intakes and deal with the trauma of those intakes, and I got a doctor. But I do not have a psychiatrist, and it's probably going to be 4 months before I have a psychiatrist. So how do we know what medication to put me on? Yeah. Because we can't just put me on anything because I've had adverse reactions to medications. Mm-hmm. That's the other thing that folks don't understand. Sometimes you take an antipsychotic and it makes you want to kill yourself. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you take an antipsychotic and the voices are worse.
Yep.
So for me, I've struggled with proper medication. I've never mm-hmm. found anything that works.
Well, and for myself too, and anyone else that I know, finding a medication that helps with more help than damage mm-hmm. is tough to find.
Yeah, and we can also talk about regular things too. Like, I don't want to gain 45 pounds.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to say that?
Yes, like, of course.
I don't want to go on lithium. That's horribly depressing and awful for me mm-hmm. when my body drastically changes. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's another thing you're not allowed to say when you're mentally ill.
Nope.
No, thanks. I don't want to go on that medication that's going to make me gain 60 pounds.
No, because
that's going to be really hard for my mental health.
This goes back to the same thing that you mentioned earlier about you're supposed to be grateful.
Yeah, well, because you don't actually have rights and boundaries when you're mentally ill.
And that's the key from everything you and I talk about all the time.
Agreed.
That's the fucking key.
That's the takeaway.
We don't have the rights. When mm-hmm. we're in crisis, we don't have the rights. When we're able to pretend and pass as neurotypical, then we get more help. Because...
Yeah, well, when we're more palpable.
That's right. And so, but the trouble that people don't understand, especially some of these services, which claim to understand addiction, mental health, and the compassionate care required, but yet it's absent every time we go for the care there.
Yeah, for right? sure. And it's not like... Yeah, 34 years, I met one doctor that was validating. Mm-hmm. I met one doctor that asked me how I wanted my care to look. Mm-hmm. One doctor in all that time.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe we got to work on that.
Totally. But this also goes into as I think about recovery in general now, right? Mm. So now you're in this process, right? This process.
Yeah, where my entire body feels brand new.
That's right.
And everything is so scary.
That's right.
I want listeners to know that though. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, so what happens after the mental breakdown?
Yeah.
Because then you do have to do the living thing.
That's right.
You know?
And so like we've talked about, so now there's options, right? So there's supposedly options for your recovery. And even though you and I both are not 12-step people.
Hate them.
We hate it.
I don't know.
You hate them. I just have no use for it. So, okay. Right?
Dave's nice. He won't hate anything.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I can hate anything. I don't feel it inside.
I can't wait till time does that for me because I can hate things.
Yeah. What I feel is that that those folks are just doing the best they can too, right? And but it's not good enough. That's my point. They're doing the best they can, but it's no longer good enough for me. And so because it's not good enough, I start looking at what about it isn't good enough. And really what it comes down to is that the program itself, not the individuals. So I'm just going to go right at the program itself.
Yeah.
Because we could talk about shitty individuals all day long in those
But programs. We're going to talk about the program.
Yeah. But
because that's our issue.
Well, yeah.
Shitty people are everywhere.
They're everywhere, no matter what program
you
go.
But AA is a cult.
it's not only is it a cult, but it's basically just a offshoot, watered down version of Christianity because it was written by two rich white Christians.
And it's predatory to preach to someone when they're already at a place of like being broken.
And it didn't occur to me until the last few years that that's what was happening. Mm-hmm. Like I remember when I started as a social worker and I wouldn't go work for the Salvation Army because they made people pray before they ate. And I was like, absolutely not will I make someone pray before
and
they
And then you
get
went to
food.
AA?
Well, and then gradually.
And you have to pray to be alive. I know.
And then once I sobered up, that was long before I sobered up, eh? Because I've been a social worker long before I've been sober. But it's like, I wouldn't go do those things back then because of that. And then I put myself in that. But I did it because it's safe, right? Yeah. And I know, and for me, and people might like wonder about this, and that's great, wonder about it. Because if you're not asking questions wherever you are, whatever world you're living in, if you assume that the rest of the world lives like you, then you're wrong.
Yeah, and also be okay with admitting others have different experiences.
Yeah.
Like I've never experienced a trans experience, but I'm not going to deny that it exists.
Of course not.
It's just not something that I've experienced, but I can totally respect that it is an experience another folk has had.
And so how helpful is it when you go into a program, any program, but specifically we're talking about the 12 steps, when you bring your trauma in and they tell you trauma's not real. And then you bring the fact that you're queer in, oh, well, you just should do the work. Don't worry about being queer. That'll work itself out.
Mm-hmm. And if you're mentally ill, you know, I was told a lot of times in the program that if I took antipsychotics, it would be a relapse.
Yes. And I honestly, I have a close friend of mine who's going through this like struggle, like in terms of that stuff. And I got to say, like, that's that dogma. It's fucking heartbreaking.
That should be fucking illegal.
It would be illegal for me to do it. It's illegal if I do it.
Yeah, as a social worker.
As it should be for anyone who says, hey, I don't know fuck all about it.
I don't know anything about your mental health at all, or, but don't take your meds.
Yeah, or about mental health in general.
Yeah.
But the truth is, AA is like, we got to be sober so you can't take it. I've heard that shit from the first time I came in, 20 years of it. The difference for me than someone who might not know any different is that I was already trained before I came in. So when people were saying shit like that, I was like, fuck you. Like, you cannot tell.
Yeah, see, that really got in my head, you know. Yeah. I think I really struggled a lot longer in my 20s with my mental health because of AA, and that's why I'm so profusely against it.
Took me the first 10 years of sobriety before I even agreed to get medicated.
But so this is another good point we're bringing up. So I can't do any of the government resources because they're all full and I'm sitting on a wait list. So then people are like, okay, well, she should go get, like, community somewhere else. She should go to AA. Mm-hmm. Well, I can't go to AA, guys. Mm-hmm. Last time I went to AA, I got sexually assaulted for about 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's not going to work. So that community is lost to me as well. Mm-hmm. And so the resources get smaller and smaller and smaller the more free thinking you are about your care.
Yeah.
The more you question your care as a mentally ill person, the less care that you have because you get deemed as unappreciative and deregulated and aggressive and resistant. You know? And so I don't want to go to a treatment center. I've been to 3 treatment centers. Mm-hmm. They didn't work for me. Because they made me feel more shame, not less shame.
Because the shame is built into those programs. And that's what we're talking about with the program instead of the people, is because that program has now been adopted by centers. Mm-hmm. So, and don't get me wrong, I was one of those people when, like 10 years ago or whatever it was when I developed our program.
You worked at a treatment center, right?
No. Oh, I worked at one, yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I didn't go to one.
You didn't go to one.
So, and the last time I worked at one, it was the last time I'll ever work for an agency again. Because it's just, it was the icing on the cake of how little we're actually helping, right? It was
and how little we actually care. You know, like, I don't think people know what it's like when you're in treatment. Like, they just make the most ridiculous rules for folks that are experiencing withdrawal.
Yeah.
Like, if somebody is going to smoke when they're experiencing, like, I'm going to tell you right now, my brief withdrawal from fentanyl and my brief withdrawal from Suboxone was absolute hell.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was hell. Yeah. I've withdrawn from heroin alone in my apartment. And it was nothing like my experience with those two things, Suboxone included, you know? So is that something that we're also talking about with people openly and honestly too? Because I don't know if it is.
We certainly weren't when it went back in the methadone days when I was working with clients who were on the methadone programs. There was no, like, I would talk about it because I would watch my folks like try to come off it.
And please, 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 if anyone is listening to us, I love methadone and Suboxone.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
I don't want those resources to go away.
We would have more deaths without them.
Love it.
Yeah.
I just want there to be more resources because for everyone, it's not the right move. Just like for everyone, treatment's not the right move.
Or AA.
Or AA.
Yeah.
For me, I have been a chronic lapser for 15 years. Mm-hmm. That's always been my use. I have periods of high functioning, hyper-perfectionate, manic experiences where I do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have these deep, deep lows, which I'm in right now, where I'm very incapable of doing anything. And it is the cycle of mania and burnout that I have lived in for 15 years.
Yeah.
And if anybody thinks that there is any part of me that's lazy, I dare them to experience that and still be here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I am going to start owning that.
Yeah.
If I'm going to stay alive and have to do this, I'm going to talk about it honestly.
Mm-hmm.
It's been hell being mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
It's been humiliating. It's been devastating. It's been embarrassing. It's been hell. So I would love to be any other way.
Yeah.
And I would love to give some support and actually figure out what's going on with me and sit down with a psychiatrist for more than 10 minutes and have someone evaluate me more than once and get a medication that works with a team that I trust.
Mm-hmm.
That's never been available to me, folks. So I'm hoping that now I will be able to advocate some sort of a situation over months. But I also have to keep myself alive this month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I went to my apartment for the first time on Friday and I'm staying there. And, like, I'm an adult woman and I'm so afraid.
Mm.
Like, I just sit in it and I am so scared. And people are probably like, what are you scared of? I'm scared the mania is going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not on an antipsychotic.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a psychiatrist yet. I haven't been re-diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't really know what's going on with me. I don't know what was going on in December. I don't know what was going on in January. And I hope that it doesn't come back. And I don't know if people know what that's like either. Like, I'm living afraid of myself every morning, waking up being like, am I getting manic? Is it coming? Is it a cycle? Will it be here soon? Mm-hmm. Because I don't know how to deal with it. It's only been the last 5 years for me. I've never had help around it. I've never talked to anyone around it. So I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I just really hope that, like, people can hear that and know that that's real. And it's not an excuse that I'm giving. It's really, really, really hard. Mm-hmm. It's really scary.
It is. It's terrifying. And just to... just to kind of carry on with that course of, sorry, I don't know how to speak.
I know, because you know how scary it is.
Well, it's terrifying, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and to try to put a point on it, another point is to say that sometimes for me, just to leave the house, it's crippling sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, it becomes crippling, right? Yeah. Because
I throw up on my hands and knees before.
100%.
Because it's that bad.
Sometimes I'm so scared because I'm not sure I can control what's happening.
Yeah.
Right? And so, oof. And those moments, like, it's, again, it goes back to that having the privilege of having a place to live. Of,
yeah, totally.
Of being employed, of all these different things. But as I get worse, like, will there be a time where I'm unemployable? I would imagine.
Well, I'm unemployable right now.
Yeah.
You know, this has never happened to me before. I've always figured it out last minute. And right now I'm having a really difficult time filling it out and that or figuring it out. And that's the other thing I just want to quickly touch on is just how the resources don't make sense. Mm-hmm. So I've applied for Alberta Works because mm-hmm. I quit all of my jobs when I was manic. That's what happens when you're manic.
Yep.
You make decisions that don't make sense. You don't. I could have gone on a medical leave. I should have had the forethought for that, but I didn't have the forethought. Mm-hmm. So I just quit everything when I couldn't manage it anymore.
And that's important to point out, not being able to have the forethought. Because
it's not an option.
Because it's in the brain. It starts in the brain. That's where our problem is.
So I didn't even know what was happening.
100%.
Like, I don't even remember it. I was having a hard time figuring out if everyone was conspiring against me or mm-hmm. not. Like, I was that paranoid all of the time. So didn't have the forethought to fill out the paperwork for a mental health leave. Mm-hmm. Just quit. So now, yeah, I've applied for Alberta Works. The most I'll get on Alberta Works is $900. My rent is $1,350. Super happy to be open and honest about mm-hmm. that. I live in a 416 square foot apartment. I do not have a partner. So no one else is splitting those bills with me. So the most I can get on assistance is $900. Well, how do I pay my rent then? Well, I have to get a job. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're allowed to work on assistance. So what's your problem, Danielle? Yes, you are. If you work on assistance, though, you get less assistance. Mm-hmm. So if I work, now I'm only going to get $500. Now I'm only going to get $300. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to have to work more and more and more so I can pay the rent. So why even be on the assistance? Because I'm just going to have to get a full-time job.
Because the idea is...
And if I get a full-time job, mm-hmm. I'll make no assistance.
The idea is for you to get off of assistance as quickly as possible.
Yeah, well, I'm going to have to because it's not going to pay my rent. So that's not going to work.
Capitalism 101, right?
So I don't get a minute to just figure out what my mental health diagnosis is and get some medication?
You've had plenty of minutes.
Oh, yeah, you're right. 34 of them.
Right.
I should have tried harder, like, as a kid.
This is it's so ridiculous, though. Like,
but that's what the attitude is.
100% is that you can't do it right enough.
Yeah, and right? I want people to know, too, that I've done every modality of therapy, mm-hmm. another privilege. You know, I did EMDR therapy, and because I'm such a beautiful disassociator, I just disassociated from the therapy.
Oh.
So it was completely ineffective. I also did trauma therapy that I paid for out of pocket. Mm-hmm. Well, I'll be honest, my parents paid for mm-hmm. out of pocket because of the little generational wealth that I have benefited from as mm-hmm. a white person. Make sure I own all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, my parents paid for trauma therapy for a year, and this is what happened. I would go to my trauma therapist and I would tell her whatever the trauma was we were on, and for 50 minutes I would tell her, like, this horrible thing, and then at the end of the 50 minutes she'd say, "Okay, have a nice day." And I would walk out into downtown Calgary and I would be so disassociated from talking about this trauma that I would instantly engage in a self-harm behavior. Mm-hmm. So what happened when I did trauma therapy, my self-harm behavior started skyrocketing. Mm-hmm. We've never been able to continue with it because it becomes too dangerous to continue the therapy. Mm-hmm. So that didn't work. So what do I need? What I need is probably a trauma therapy center
mm-hmm.
where I can go and unpack that and honestly be watched.
And be safe. Yeah.
And be safe.
Yeah.
But those are on average $40,000 a month. I don't have $40,000 a month. No one I know has $40,000 a month.
I don't even know anybody who has that.
And unfortunately, I have 34 years of trauma. Mm. So I think maybe it's going to take more than a month.
Very well could, yeah.
So those are not options.
No.
So what, I can't get in to see a psychiatrist. I can't get on medication. None of the other modalities have worked.
Mm-hmm.
so what do I do?
Yeah.
Right? And I guess the government says I would probably apply for MAID.
Mm-hmm.
And MAID is medically assisted suicide. And it's probably the only application that would get approved.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my AISH application has been denied twice, if folks are wondering if I haven't tried that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a classic example of my high functioning nature.
It's also a classic example of how difficult AISH is made.
Well, nobody can even get AISH right now because I've been told that there's a freeze on AISH being accepted, period, right now. But yeah.
That's surprising.
My AISH application has been denied twice because I've been deemed too high functioning because I don't take medication. But the reason why I don't take medication is because typically the medication is a benzo, and I am a benzo user, so it has not worked for me.
Well, and some medications, what folks might not understand too, some of these antipsychotics, SSRIs, all these different medications that we take for that we might take for depression, anxiety, bipolar, BPD, whatever the or schizophrenia, whatever the case may be. There's combinations of these medications that make it more dangerous than not taking them.
And nobody is monitoring me.
No.
I live alone, right? Yeah. So if I do have a negative reaction, and that's what my doctor said on Friday, is that she doesn't want to put me on anything right now because I don't have enough of a team monitoring me.
Mm-hmm.
And if things go south, I'm alone in my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wonder if people can understand what that's like. Like, imagine you were told, like, you have cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's super aggressive. We need to take it out, but we're not going to for a while. And you have to fill out all these applications. And maybe this is what it's like for cancer. I don't know. But I know it's what it's like from being mentally ill. Like, you know that you have this, like, I'm terrified of the mania coming back. I do not know how to handle it. And I have no resource at this point to help me with that. You know, and that doctor was great, but the next time I see her is the 15th and it's on the phone. She didn't even have an appointment available in person.
Yeah.
So I'm in the middle of a crisis. I'm not going to see her for 2 weeks, and then I'm going to have a 20-minute phone call combo with her.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, that is her probably going out of her way.
Yeah.
She probably actually doesn't have that 20 minutes. It's probably, like, her bathroom break.
Yeah.
So, like, thanks to her. And this is a moment where we can say thank you to the good nurses and doctors who are incredibly burnt out right now.
And all the good social workers out there, too.
And all the good social workers. I've been real hard on social workers lately, but I did have a really positive experience with a social worker at the Safe Consumption site. So I want to shout that out to folks that are maybe listening who are experiencing issues themselves. I went and saw the social worker at the Safe Consumption site, and she's an absolute gem. She's helping me out with so much. So if you need support that way, that's a big place that I recommend.
Yeah.
But who knows if SafeWorks is even going to be around if Danielle Smith keeps digging the grave of harm reduction.
Oh, yeah.
So I hope that we all realize how vital that resource is, even if it's not perfect.
And if Danielle does decide to shut it all down in Alberta, hopefully they got a big plot of land where we can put the bodies.
Yeah.
Because that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, and make sure to note that those bodies will mainly be Indigenous.
Yep.
Purposefully.
Yeah, and on the tombstone over the whole graveyard will just be Danielle Smith did this.
Yeah, and welcome. I think that's really the goal. So it's I just want people to know that, and I don't want to go on and on, but I definitely tried to access everything that I could access as somebody who helps others access resource.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's what I do when I am doing outreach. I'm trying to help people with whatever they need. So I know the numbers to call. I know the words to say. I have very strong verbal skills, obviously. That's not something that I struggle with. So what are other people doing who don't have that? I have all the privilege in the world, and I can't get any help.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I will have another manic episode. That's what will happen, because that will be my life for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
So hopefully I'll get a team and I'll learn how to manage it
and
I'll get a job and I'll save my apartment and I won't have to look at anything else because I have a dog. And this is another thing. We don't allow mentally ill people to have joy. If you're on assistance, you can't have a dog. You can't have a long-term partnership. You know, all of those things threaten your ability to get assistance. People don't know that either.
No, and they don't know that if you are if you're on AISH and you move in with your partner,
you lose your AISH.
You lose your AISH. And if your partner makes over a certain amount, you lose everything.
Yeah.
They take away even your medical benefits at a certain point. So.
Yeah, you're not even allowed to grow and, like, prosper with another person because the goal is to keep you in poverty.
Yeah. And of course, when you start in this day and age, if you have a reasonable salary, it's not going to cover two people for long.
No, and that's the other thing too, is like, like the idea that, like, someone could just take care of another person. How many of us could take care of another person on our salary?
Oh, God, yeah.
Could you take care of another person?
Fuck no.
Yeah.
I've already tried.
Well, you take care of Floyd.
Yeah, but Floyd's easy going. Like, he's pretty good.
He's probably cheap, hey?
He's pretty cheap. Yeah.
My animals are so expensive because my dog's so big.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Your dog's a wild dog, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything in my house is a little wild and feral, me included. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that would say, like, she shouldn't even have a dog. Mm-hmm. If she doesn't know how to take care of herself, why would we let her have a pet? Mm-hmm. Figure it out.
Yeah.
I don't want to pay for her pet's kibble.
And I'd be like, well, here's the thing about having pets when you are isolated and mentally ill. Is it might be the only thing that keeps you from jumping off the goddamn roof.
The only reason that I phoned the community paramedics on myself on January 28th mm-hmm. was because I could sense that my dog was afraid. Mm-hmm. I knew that I was scaring my dog. Mm-hmm. And I love my dog so much and I didn't want to scare her. So that's the other thing that we need to understand. Like, the idea that we need people who use substances and people who use drugs to, like, feel worse about their behaviors, I just fundamentally don't agree.
Disagree
100%. I feel so horrific and horrible about the times when I'm unwell. And I know when I hurt people, and I know when my family is afraid for my well-being. And I want people to know that in those times, I'm also afraid for my well-being. Mm.
And, of course, you're wishing, I'm wishing, that those times weren't happening.
Deeply.
Right? Like, deeply. And
deeply.
For folks to think that it's a matter of us not maybe doing all that we could, first of all, that's just wrong. It's just fundamentally wrong.
Maybe we all just have different ability.
Well, we do have different abilities.
And, like, maybe that's okay. And if you were able to get through something and it not hold you down for months and months, congratulations, I'm not.
Yeah.
When someone leaves me and I have a breakup and I have a big change to my routine, I struggle. Mm-hmm. And I need a little extra support. Mm-hmm. And I have had a very hard time getting that support in my life.
Yeah.
And that's a very privileged white woman take.
Well, and this comes from a city that prides itself on having lots of resources, right?
Yeah, and I think you hear that from conservatives constantly.
But that's all you hear it from, are conservatives and the media, mm-hmm. right? Because when you, like, your experience just over the last couple months has shown that that's not the case. And if it's not the case for you,
it's a privileged white woman,
you can guarantee it's not the case for Indigenous folks who are unhoused, who mm-hmm. potentially are mentally ill as well. Mm-hmm. Like, the list of things that are barriers goes on and on and on, mm-hmm. right? Especially within this society. Because I talk to people all the time who literally think that us supporting a free Palestine is problematic for the system. And I'm like, it absolutely is problematic for the system, and that's why we do it. Because the system is fucked. And that's why we need to do this.
Right? Well, and that's the other point that I want to make is, like, I hear a lot of people say, like, oh, it's a broken system, it's a broken system. No, it is not. Nope. It is working exactly as it is intended to work.
And it's fucked.
The goal here is to weed us out, because we don't make good soldiers and we don't make good mm-hmm. pushers for the capitalist agenda, because we are soft and sensitive and emotionally mm-hmm. well. And maybe if we we're not emotionally well, but we're emotionally aware. Mm-hmm. We're seeing what's happening. We're feeling what's happening. Why has it always been so strange that I've had an emotional reaction to my life? Mm-hmm. Are you not supposed to have an emotional reaction to the life that you are living? Mm-hmm. Maybe mentally ill people are just closer to that root, man. Mm-hmm. Maybe we're just closer to what we actually should be.
Well, there's no buffer for us.
Maybe under capitalism, it makes a lot of sense if you're struggling. Mm. I have had a very hard time finding a safe place to be in this society. Mm-hmm. It's been incredibly difficult for me.
Yeah, you and me both. It's just been, you find within your community, there's this small community. Like, I'm speaking specifically of my experience with AA, right? And and going from, I thought, okay, what I need to do is be a part of this, starting this new queer group so that it'll be more focused on queer people.
Well, right? Yeah, and you were also probably trying to get yourself to stay by pretending 100%. That it could be queer friendly.
100%.
And it can't be queer friendly if it's Christian.
And sorry. That's my point too, was eventually I noticed that even the queer meeting, as much as I love some of the people there,
totally,
and the ladies who we started together, I love them. They're great. However, the program is still AA.
Yeah.
And
so in that AA program, does not want you to be queer.
It does not.
Christianity does not want you to be queer.
Does not.
You can't just put a flag on a church and say, "Well, we still don't think they're going to go to heaven, but they can be here. They can pay the fucking what do you do at a church? You pay your little, like, peace be with you wishes.
Put your tithe or whatever.
Thank you. I forgot the word. I knew you would know it.
Yeah, tithing or offering, whatever.
Tithing. Ooh, I hate that word.
Yeah, I know. It's gross. It's pretty gross when you think about what you're funding. But it's kind of the same thing with anything, right? Like, you really have, I think people have a choice. Like, obviously we have a choice as to what we support. Trouble is, up until the last few years, that's all we had.
Yeah, well, this is what we were talking about last night with, like, mutual aid and stuff. So if people are trying to figure out, like, what they can do to be more supportive of neurodivergent folks, I would say support mutual aid organizations. Yeah. Don't support nonprofits.
Yeah.
Figure out who's doing grassroots. Mm-hmm. Figure out who's doing... The movement is being led by the people who are experiencing it.
Yeah.
Not that we're getting a seat at the table, but that you're not co-opting our movement.
Mm-hmm.
Let me lead the movement. Let us lead the movement.
Yeah, because we don't want the institutions.
I don't want your neurotypical take on what it's like to be neurodivergent.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I don't think that you know better than me.
It's like when we hear like some figurehead on TV
talk
about like what people should, how people should be living or what this means. It's like, go fuck yourself.
Man, I had to come back to my apartment that was covered in puke and blood and clean it up by myself.
Yeah.
With no sympathy from anyone because that was the mess I made.
Yeah.
You know? And now I got to live in that apartment. Mm. And now I got to maybe experience another manic episode in that apartment alone. And maybe I'll find community, but I'm not finding that community at a nonprofit anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's not there.
Well, and this is where I was like, we were talking about last night,
I thought that was really powerful when we talked about that.
Oh, it was, but it's so important.
Because there is no community in nonprofit.
There's no community in groups now, like this, right? We were talking about finding that community and
where
then,
can we get it?
Yeah, and we're so, when we're new and we're fresh and we're raw.
You need it.
Just
right now, I need it.
100%.
I need somewhere to go because I'm crawling out of my skin alone in my apartment because I'm so scared.
Yeah.
I hope people hear how scared I am. I'm so afraid that it's going to happen again. And I don't know what I'll do better.
Yeah.
You know, the doctor was like, are you feeling stable? No.
Yeah.
Do you feel stable?
No.
I asked you that last night. You said,
Yeah.
I don't remember a time where I felt stable.
Yeah. I think I probably feel as stable as I felt in a while.
But you put a lot of work into that.
100%.
Like a lot of your time is about protecting that.
Oh, yeah. And that means what people might not understand about that. What that means is I protect it like to the point where outside of work, I'm very careful as to what I do, right? Mm-hmm. Just because of that energy. And
you spend a lot of time alone regulating.
Yep, I have to.
That's what I know about you.
Yep, I have to. If I don't spend a lot of time, and this is where, you know, we come from this place of, wow, when I first sobered up, I was like, I'm just a loner. Well, yeah, I'm a loner because that helps me regulate easier.
Yeah, I need a lot of that time.
Yeah.
When something happens, I need a lot of that time to process it.
Yep.
Because I just feel it deeply.
Well, and we're talking about the dissociation, and I really appreciate the honesty that we can talk to each other with.
Because we're both mentally ill.
Yeah. And
I've never met anyone who has BPD but you.
Well, neat. I've met lots of people. Like
never.
Yeah. And I find it.
Well, that's not true. I mean a man.
Ah,
it's not as common for men.
Yeah, no, I understand that it's not. And I feel kind of special, really.
You are so special.
Right, so special.
Special.
But trying to figure out, like, the fact that it does take so much time to regulate, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that, like, my brain doesn't receive, process, and perceive information the same way other people do, right? So it's like, it's not about other people. Like, that's what I want to make clear. You could be perfectly nice to me. It's not about that. It's about my brain.
It's just, I'm taking the stimuli in different, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
And that's the thing people don't get as well, is like, even good things are hard for me.
Yep.
Because they feel unlike my default. So that's been the other struggle that I've had, because I've had so much stacked trauma, complex trauma, like you. I've developed sort of an adverse reaction to being well, because it feels unsafe, because it's not where I've lived for the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So part of my journey in battle has been, when I'm doing well, my brain is actually like, whoa, 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 this is bad. Screw this up. Self-sabotage.
Well, and what I don't know about you, is that typically when like mania sets in, is when the too excited,
it is. Good point.
Because I know for me, if I get too up, like excited about something, I go manic and then I'm terrified.
And that is the case too. Like, a new relationship can make me manic. So like anything in my life that, and basically anytime my routine changes, I'm either going to respond to that with mania or low.
Yeah.
It's going to be one or the other.
Yeah.
Like after, so last night was my first night home and I went and hung out with you because I didn't want to be alone, which was very nice of you.
Well, I did it because you're my homie.
Yeah, we're homies.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, and then I went home and I slept and it was fine. Nothing happened. But I woke up this morning and I was so sad.
Mm.
I was so sad in my apartment. Oh my God, I felt like horrifically uncomfortable. Like all my skin was brand new. I had no idea what to do with myself. Everything seems foreign. It doesn't seem like my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
and everyone is so worried about me, so I don't want to tell anyone this is how I feel. But yeah, it's really hard coming back after the episodes too.
No doubt.
That's where the full-timeness of being mentally ill comes in, is it's like, now I'm in the cleaning up process again, which is like so painful. Everything is so raw in the beginning again.
Yeah, it is.
And that's been my life for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. Burn it down, raw it out, build it up, do it again, repeat. And I that's just been my life, man. Mm-hmm.
Well, anytime, I'm, like I said yesterday, anytime you want to hang out.
I know, we just talked for an hour and a half. We have to stop talking now.
We don't have to.
Well, we have to stop the podcast.
I guess.
No one listens to a two-hour podcast.
Well, it depends on how nice it is. I think this is a good one.
People, fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. And if they don't listen, that's okay
too. I'll listen to it.
Yeah, you and I will listen.
Yeah, we will.
We'll hear it.
And then we'll talk again.
Yeah, and then I'll make Darcy listen to it.
Okay, you have to, he does have to.
I'll make Darcy listen to it so we can edit it. Because he's obviously not paying attention. Yeah. He's obviously falling asleep out there.
Yeah, I would.
But Danielle, thank you so much. I know this stuff is not easy to talk about. And for those people out there who might think that we're a little cavalier about it, try to understand that we've been going through this most of our lives.
Yeah, and we've just found a comfort in one another because we both experienced this the same. So if this sounded like lackadaisical or like too, like we were making light of it or something, it's just because we're two people who see each other the same way. So there's a comfortableness here. We can sort of take that like armor off and just sort of like show up as the people who exist and experience this. So yeah, I don't want anyone to be offended by that. But no, it is very comforting when you meet another person who's sort of we've sort of been to the same places with our mental illness.
We have been, and there's a bond there.
Super bond.
Right? And the fact that we choose to be very open about our illnesses to each other.
Yeah, and we speak a lot. We do a lot of like co-processing through communication. I can't believe I just said that.
I can.
That makes me feel embarrassed.
Why?
But yeah, no, we're co-processing friends.
We are.
We just like to talk, man. Listen to our next podcast.
Yeah, and there'll definitely be another one, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, like, you know, I'll kick it along for another couple months. We'll see what happens then.
We'll just take it one day at a time. And
flashbacks. Hey. One day at a time.
Well, the good news about that philosophy is, if people out there have a hard time with AA or whatever, the philosophy of one day at a time is not AA's philosophy. It is the philosophy.
You mean some white men stole something from someone else?
I know it's hard to believe.
In their theory?
I know it's hard to believe.
Does that ever happen?
It's never happened before.
Oh, I
hasn't happened since.
Not under patriarchy.
No. It was just this one time these two rich white guys, straight rich white guys, probably doing acid, decided they were going to steal some stuff from other cultures.
Yeah.
And they did what other white people have done for centuries.
Colonized.
Yeah, they colonized. They colonized alcoholism.
Yay!
Well, they technically did, though. They technically colonized alcoholism.
Okay, we have to stop. We can't start talking about that now.
Why?
Bye, listeners.
I want to keep talking.
I'm shutting them down. You're done. I'm putting them in a timeout.
Are you putting me in timeout?
Yeah.
I just think that it's like, for me to come out of that lifestyle of, it's been really like tricky. Right?
Yeah.
Like it's been tricky for me. And because I do have some friends that are still there, obviously, and I don't hate people like we talked about earlier. Like, and it doesn't bother me what people do to feel good.
If it's working and they're not harming anyone, great. I just think a lot of people are harming people.
And that's what I saw, and that's why I can't keep endorsing it. Like, for anyone out there who's curious as to where I've been or why I'm not around.
Whoa, is this your I Hate AA stance?
No, not I Hate AA.
On my podcast? Yeah.
Yeah.
I co-opted your podcast.
You did. You totally did. This is about like just me talking to my friends out there. Like, you didn't do anything. It's not about you. It's about the programs, right? It's about like when I left the cops. It's not about the people that I got close to.
It's never about the people, man.
It was about the system.
I don't fault anyone who's trying to find a group.
It's about the system that they represent and that they protect and defend, right?
Yeah.
And just like the church. There's people within the church that are just
beautiful
great.
And cute and amazing 100%. And kind and loving and wonderful.
It's just not the bulk
like
of
your
them.
Mom.
Yeah.
But you it's know, not the bulk of them. You know, your mom's a dream.
She is. She's amazing. But the bulk of people within those institutions are the people that have no problem taking money from a nonprofit, right?
Yeah.
They have no problem taking donations that were meant for someone else.
And or those, taking a grant they don't really apply for.
Or taking a grant they don't, well, they applied for it, but they don't use it the way it's supposed to, and then they just make up the report, right? And so, like, those kinds of things. Like, example is a church is doing some fucking project with someone. And
Dave, I'm going to kick you with my boot. We have to stop this podcast.
Oh, do we? Okay.
Yes!
Why?
It's been an hour and a half, right?
Yeah, but we're okay. Darcy, are you okay?
We're okay.
Yeah, are you okay?
We're okay.
Are you mad out there, Darcy?
It's validating for me.
He's good.
Okay, yeah. But I mean, that's long.
I like it.
Okay.
Because and first of all, I just don't want to let you go. So we got you on here for a second time.
Romance on the podcast.
Yeah, it's called what do we call it?
He doesn't want to let me go because it's cold out there.
Yeah, it's cold out there too. And snowy.
I know, and I have to live in that?
I know.
Come on.
So fucking
snowy. Give me Aish. And it's going to snow?
Yeah.
And we're supposed to get
10 centimeters, 10 more centimeters of snow. Ugh. Yeah. Yeah, it's just a strange. Thank you for coming in, and again,
you're welcome.
We can totally cut this off, but like I'm just so happy to see you, and so happy that you're back.
Me. Yeah, I'm happy that I'm back, and that I hope I get a psychiatrist soon.
I hope you do too.
And I hope people know that people need to see psychiatrists when they need to see them.
Yeah,
not 6 to 8 weeks later.
Thank you for bringing me back to our podcast after that little bit of a divergence.
I'm good at that.
You are really good at that. I bet you'd be really good with your own podcast. Sure.
I would never do that.
No?
No, because I would say sometimes I can get too personal. I'm sure the folks out there can't believe that. But yeah, sometimes I can get too personal, I think.
Yeah, I don't feel like there is a too personal, right?
Well,
like
that's why you're a person who likes me.
I suppose, right? Yeah.
There's two categories.
That's true.
There's never been a middle ground on me. You like me or you don't.
Yeah. And that's, they're fair enough.
Some people don't like it. Some people are like, why do you gotta be heavy all the time?
Yeah. Well, because you are heavy.
Yeah, and I also think that that's what makes me able to be light.
Mm-hmm.
I got to get it out, man.
Of course you do.
And you got to get yours out too, but you're just better at burying than I am.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's all it is. Maybe neurotypicals just bury better.
Yeah.
Because I'm not very good at burying it in the backyard. It always comes back up for me.
Yeah, me neither.
It's coming back up for me, and I want to get it out of my body, and I can't find a place to get it out of my body.
Whatever I try to bury comes up, so there is no burying it. It's just a matter of like, I dissociate it for a long enough time, and then all of a sudden I got to deal with it, right?
Like, yeah, or realize I don't remember any of my life. Because that's what I'm really struggling with right now is like, I don't remember what's happening to me, probably on purpose, but it's starting to get hard to keep living.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very sad note to end it on. But
I appreciate it because the fact of the matter is we're not going to end. We don't have to end this like a Bell Let's Talk, right? Because the truth is.
Because it's not.
It's not a Bell Let's Talk.
The truth is I can't get mental health resources. The truth is I have a super demonized mental health illness. Like Google BPD. It'll pretty much be articles of don't ever date or be friends or talk to us.
Yeah.
It's that was a time. I remember in my 20s when I made that mistake because I had a boyfriend tell me to do it. He's like, Google your mental illness. So I did. And it's basically just like, don't ever talk to these people. Don't ever love these people. Don't ever be around these people. Run.
And it talks about how we can't love and how we can't
do all and how we're manipulative
things.
At our core and we're bad people at our core.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's the other thing too, is like, I guess maybe there are people that are like, okay, she couldn't get government resource. She couldn't get community resource. So she can just do it on her own. Right. Well, that's what happens when I Google my own mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It pretty much tells me that I like don't deserve to be here and I'm fundamentally unlovable. So that hasn't really worked for me either.
Well, and to further that, like what you might find online about BPD, it then gets like reinforced by people's opinions of BPD, right?
Well, yeah. And how many times has that been said to me in my own life that I'm too much or whatever, manipulative or... And I'm sure there are times that I have been those things. Mm-hmm. I think there are probably times where we've all been those things.
For sure.
I know that I deeply don't want to use my mental illness as an excuse for poor behavior.
Of course not.
I know that my trauma has caused me to have a disorganized attachment style, and I know that I have absolutely been abusive in partnership in a way that makes me feel great shame. And I know that I deeply want to work through that trauma so that I can show up with intimate partners in a healthy way. But I know that it's going to take a lot of time and effort to build that secure attachment and to work through that trauma. And I'm having a really hard time finding the resources to help support me while I do that. So if we want to cure addiction, like Danielle Smith says, or if we want to cure all of these things that people don't want to talk about, maybe we just need to actually like chill out on that and just listen to folks that are experiencing it.
Yeah.
Just let us be there in society with resource.
Yeah. And try to stop telling us what we need.
And try to stop denying our existence.
Yeah. Yeah. And if the internet could help, I'm just kidding. The
internet
doesn't
and
help
if
anyone.
Everyone who says a mean thing about BPD could take their TikTok down. I want to get a boyfriend one day.
Take down your TikToks. I'm just kidding. But like the truth is, that's our life. Like, and to try to put a point on it in terms of how helpful people can be without doing a whole lot. So like I drove my friend up north this last week so that she could go and visit her family back home where she's from. And we stopped in Edmonton so she could go with her friends the rest of the way to her home, to her reservation. And while we were there, obviously we met them at the West Edmonton Mall. Mm-hmm. That's because they were there doing some shopping and stuff. So we met them there, but the mall's a fucking nightmare. Like, parking's a nightmare. They got construction all over. It's a fucking nightmare.
Okay, there. The worst thing about you is when you hate driving.
100%, because I don't like driving
it's
to
so
begin
strange.
With. I know.
You get bad road rage. I would never have thought that about you.
So we're sitting there in the parking lot, and of course, I'm not mad at anyone. Like, I'm
you
not.
You just get really
I'm
uppity
just,
when you drive.
I just really.
You don't like driving.
I don't like driving. So when I do it, I don't like it, and it starts to aggravate me.
I don't like
and then of course
either.
When the conditions are worse, it's worse. So like
of course.
Cuz and then I feel my mental illness kick in with mm-hmm. the dissociation.
Which is why I don't drive.
Right? Which is why I'm getting to a place where I'm not going to drive anymore is because
I'm too disassociated to safely do it.
100%. I'm seeing the same shit. I'm seeing like I can drive safely, but it's the behavior around driving that doesn't make me feel safe.
Yeah.
Right? And of course, other drivers.
I couldn't relate to you more on that one.
Yeah.
And we both have BPD, so yep. Interesting, right? We're sharing an experience here, mm-hmm. and maybe it's not an excuse. Maybe it actually is safer for me not to drive.
It's not an excuse. This is the thing. Once we realize that this is who we are and how we feel, it stops becoming an excuse. It becomes part of who we are. Like,
yeah. I've had a hard time having that be accepted by folks, though, in my
100%.
Life.
100%. And folks will still not want to accept it. But here's what I'm going to say about it. So we're in the mall, parking
oh, yeah.
lot. Didn't get out of the car. We're sitting in the car, and Ladine can tell that I'm fucking stressed. Like, I am, like, I dissociated.
You just get stressed driving.
Yep, and it happened instantly.
Quick.
And then I dissociated, and I wasn't even there anymore. All she did was she touched my shoulder.
Mm.
She just touched it and said, it's okay. It's
so
okay.
Loving.
And
no judgment.
No judgment.
Not asking you to stop.
Nope.
Not embarrassing you. Not talking
nope.
about how it's impacting her.
Just saying it's okay.
Yeah.
And it was, seriously, the compassion from a friend.
Yes.
Just simply saying it's okay.
And that is all we want.
It brought me right back into my body.
That is all we need.
Right? 100%.
We act like BPD is so difficult to deal
yep.
with. All we need is to be validated.
Just a little bit of like, I know how hard this is.
Yeah.
Okay. Right?
Just for 1 second.
And all it took was 1 second, Danielle.
And then you can make it about you and you can say, actually, you know, your backseat driving is freaking me out a little bit. Mm-hmm. I need you to chill out. And I'll say, good point. I should chill out.
Mm-hmm.
But just give me for 1 second the recognition that what I'm experiencing is hard and real.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to show up in the world deregulated. Mm-hmm.
No.
It's embarrassing.
Oh, it's awful.
It's horrible.
It's awful. When you can't,
it's
when I can't stop myself.
Oh, gosh. The shame.
Oh, and there's times where I'll be walking and it starts coming out of my mouth. Like, what's in my brain?
Oh, yeah.
And people probably think it's about them, but it's not. Like, it's just so much about me.
Yeah. There's times when I'm walking and I'm sobbing and
yeah.
people on the street are looking at me afraid of me. And I'm like, yeah. oh, yeah, this is, you're mentally ill.
And I catch myself, the same thing. I catch myself in public when I start talking to myself. And I'm
mm-hmm.
like, fuck, man, you can't do this in public, bro. Like,
I know.
You people can't deal with this, right? And,
they can't.
And they can't. Well, they won't.
They won't.
They don't want to because it's uncomfortable.
But yeah, I think that's a good point to make is like, what can you do for someone
mm-hmm.
who is experiencing any of the stuff we've talked about, mania,
yeah.
borderline, any of it?
Yeah.
Just be there for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to solve anything.
Nope.
You don't need, like, what is helpful for me right now? It's helpful when people say, holy, you're going through a lot.
Yeah.
Not when people say, well, don't worry, you're going to find the right doctor and it's going to work out and stick it, because that really feels invalidating. It
because
actually makes me feel worse.
It's Pollyanna bullshit. And
yeah.
You know it's Pollyanna bullshit.
What I want to hear is like, yeah, you're kind of
mm-hmm.
screwed right now and
yeah.
I love you and I'm your friend
mm-hmm.
and I'll be here.
Yeah.
And however you show up, I'll be here. And that doesn't give me free reign to do whatever I want to people.
Nope.
I don't want it to be confused.
It's
but
not what it's about.
Just let me have my emotional experience, please.
Mm-hmm.
Because when other people give me that validation,
mm-hmm.
it's way easier for me to be alive.
Oh, it makes a world of difference.
Like, yeah.
I instantly was calm and I instantly was back in my body saying, oh, yeah, I have no real reason to be mad. I don't know why.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. And that's what I hope we can do for each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, in some way, whatever that looks like. As we're doing whatever work we do,
mm-hmm.
you know, is to try to share that compassion.
And if you think, when someone says this, if you think, why do I have to help people have an easier life?
Mm-hmm.
You need to take a look at that.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because I have no problem helping the people that I love and even the people that I do not know.
Oh,
experience the world easier.
Yeah.
And if your first response to me saying, hey, could you just validate my emotional experience so I could have an easier time mm-hmm. being alive, is like, well, why do I have to live my life for you? If that's your first response, I'm so sorry that you're that hard on yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry that the world has been that hard on you.
Yeah.
I hope you realize that we are allowed to have emotional needs. Mm-hmm. And that's what is going to make things better. If I could talk openly and honestly about my mental health experience with the people in the world mm-hmm. and ask for the things that I need to show up regulated, mm-hmm. that'd help a lot.
Yeah.
And then I don't have to sit on your resources, conservative people, mm-hmm. because I'll be safe and happy and employed and doing well.
Yeah, it's amazing what happens when people are treated well.
Yeah, and validated like and alive. Heard and listened to. Yeah. Like, that doctor probably will think nothing of it, but her saying to me, that sounds hard, it sounds like you've had a hard life, mm-hmm. life-changing for me. Yeah. I have thought about nothing since that. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like a million times better. Mm-hmm. And I actually feel like being a little compassionate with myself. And it's probably why I was able to not drink last night, even though I was coming out of my skin, because mm-hmm. for 1 second I was like, someone saw me. Mm-hmm. I'll keep trying. And for me, not drinking is good. I'm not making any statement about sobriety. That's just what I got to do right now, because I'm afraid of what's happening.
Yep.
But yeah, that made a huge difference, and it will make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. And I hope that we can just show up in a little bit more of an empathetic way to people when we don't understand what's going on for them.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think we should finish it there.
Okay.
I think that was well said.
High five. High fives. From the room.
From the room to the everybody.
End.
Yeah.
Bye.